Thank you, Shira. And I will just repeat the wishes for those who are still in Yom HaZikaron mode. We should all have long life and good health, and we should remember those who paid the ultimate price for the state of Israel. And to those who are already in Yom HaAtzmaut mode, because you're in Israel, because I believe where it's just the transition moment, we wish you Chag HaAtzmaut Sameach, and you shall have a wonderful, meaningful and wonderful Yom HaAtzmaut. I've always been amazed at the ability for regular learning class schedules to dovetail and coincide with current events and current calendar related items. And today is no exception. This class was scheduled in the sequence of Sefer Daniel. It's a class literally that I have pulled and given over as a separate Yom HaAtzmaut shir in various contexts. So it actually becomes a particularly appropriate message for us all. But that by way of introduction. So we're going to jump right in. And I'm going to share my screen. All right. So this is Daniel Perichet. And as I said last week, Daniel Perichet is in Hebrew. We went through the chapter last week. Once it's in Hebrew and not Aramaic, I'm able to go back to my favorite website for teaching sources, which is Daniel Perichet, which is Al HaTorah. As this is the Hebrew original text and the translation side by side. And we had spent a good deal of time, and we're going to finish that discussion today, hopefully, with this vision of the two animals, the ram and the goat and the two horns and the four horns or one horn that divides into four and what they represent. And at the end of the chapter, Daniel is standing there and he's watching and the Malachim having a conversation about this little horn or this king that is going to wage war against the heavens. And he asks, Veshma echad kadosh medaber ve'echad kadosh lepamonia medaber ad matay echazon atamid ve'apesh shomem tet v'kodosh v'tzava mirmas. How long will this vision concerning the continuing burnt offerings and appalling transgression be? How long will it be to allow the sanctuary to be trampled upon? Until 2,300, evening morning. And then, the sanctuary shall be victorious. Daniel is looking at this. He doesn't understand it. He turns to the local, to the Malach that he sees. The Malach is named here later in the chapter, Malach Gabriel. And he says, what does all this, what does all this mean? And the Malach says to him, I'm telling you what will be Bacharita Za'am at the end of the time of anger, Kila Mu'ed Ketz, the appointed time. And as far as the animals go, the ram with the two horns, Akronaim, Malchim Adai Paras, that's the dual kingdom of Persia and Mede. And as far as the Tzfir HaSa'ir, Melech Yavan, as far as the goat, that is the king of Greece, and the great horn is the one first king, and then the four kings, the four horns that will emerge, Avatishberet, that will break, Vatamotna in his place, Arba Tachta will come four kingdoms that will arise out of the one kingdom, Arba Malchuyot, and that shall stand, but not with his power. And at the end of this time, Achrit Malchutam, when their transgressions have completed, there will be a terrible king, Malach Azpanim, fierce, Mivin Chidot, understanding strategy, and he will wage war literally with the heavens. V'yatzam kocho v'lo b'kocho, and v'yashchit rabim, he will destroy much, and that is the and that's all it says. And then it says Umareha Erev Haboker Ashene Ama Emetu, as for the vision of the evenings and the mornings, that is true. However, you Daniel Stoma Chazon Yamim Rabim, seal it up, close it up for many years to come. And the parak ends with this extraordinary mystery. What are we talking about? What is this Alpaim Shloshmoth, this 2,300 Erev Boker, this time frame that will eventually lead to this king of this arrogant Azpanim king being removed, and Achamit Azam, this end of the indignation, this time of the appointed time. Even Daniel is confused. Ani Daniel, I fainted, I was sick. I got up, I didn't understand. Eshtomem ala mar'eh ve'en mivin. I was appalled, shocked at the vision. I did not understand. So I could stop here and say, if Daniel couldn't understand it, we don't have a chance, and we could all go home. But I have to do something with this. So last week, we spent a good deal of time looking at what I would call the classic approach, which is the majority of the vast majority of commentaries who understood the notion of Acharit Malchutam, Acharit Azam, Acharit Ketz, all of these references to some kind of eschatological vision of Yemot HaMashiach, some kind of time of the ultimate redemption. And so, therefore, the 2300 being somehow connected to the years of history in exactly the same context that we saw in the previous, I'm going to actually stop sharing for a second because I can see you, in the previous conversation that we had in the previous chapters that talked about various time and a half and the other numbers and the Rishonim who go out of their way to try to figure out how to calculate those years and dovetail them with biblical history. And then in that context, the moment you're dealing with biblical history, so then, of course, you're dealing with the other question of how much do we really have accurate, specific dates to Jewish history. The only real attempt to give specific years and dates is the Medrash Seder Olam, and the Rishonim relied heavily on it. And that is assuming, of course, that we're looking at this as a sweep of history all the way to Yemot HaMashiach. However, we've already introduced the suggestion back in the earlier chapters that Daniel may not be looking at history in that kind of a broad sweep. That his sights might be narrower than just a kind of a sweep all the way or a view all the way out to what we call Yemot HaMashiach, which is this undefined time in the future. And then he might have actually, like all the Nevi'im, might have been talking about at least a potential of a redemption much sooner than that. And his vision may have been a reference to events that are much more local in terms of the time period. And here it brings us to, and I'm going to go back to sharing this now. I apologize for the jump back and forth. But here it brings us to the Ibn Ezra. And the Ibn Ezra really is the first, I think, to try to rethink this whole text in a slightly different way. And I don't have the translation of the Ibn Ezra. I apologize. If anybody has a good online source for a translation of the Ibn Ezra, I would love for you to send that to me. But I'm going to have to just read and translate as we go. The rest of it has all English translations. But for now, these two sources, I will translate. So he starts with the reference.
Looks like Rabbi Shulman lost his connection. So we will give him a minute to reconnect. He did have a problem just prior to class, so he should be able to reconnect in just a couple minutes. It took him only a couple minutes last time, so I apologize. Yeah, he's rebooting now, so hopefully this will only be a very brief pause. I apologize for the delay.
Okay. I apologize for that. Is everybody back?
You're back?
Can you all see me? Am I back? Yeah, back. I apologize for that. I was having some computer glitches this morning, which I thought I solved. I guess not. So we're going to work with what we've got. I think this will work. I've just reconnected some other way. Can everybody see me clearly?
We can see you, but I have a message that your bandwidth is low.
That's what I was afraid of. That is correct. Okay, hang on a second. I'm going to try one more time. Just give me one second. My voice and just share my screen and turn my video off. Okay?
Sure.
You all good? I apologize for that, but that at least will preserve. You can all still hear me, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
So everybody, I apologize. Else
here? We're going to do this by audio and share screen. Hopefully that will work. Okay. So Rav Tzadnya Gaon is the first, the earliest in this sequence of Rishonim and Gaonim to suggest that the Alpayim Shlosh Meot are years. And Ibn Ezra takes him to task, and then he sets everybody else in direct, right? It's his interpretation that then gets fine-tuned by Rashi and Malbim and Abarbanel and everybody else. And he says, Ma tam l'achal misham? Why would you start from Gotzray? More importantly, Erev Boker, the whole phrase Erev Boker is Lefi Da'ato Kvar Avar, right? The 2,300 years of Erev Boker long since passed, and so has every other calculation. So the Ibn Ezra says something extraordinary, and he says, wait a second, we're thinking this wrong. Hanachon ve'inai, ki sheish shanim v'chodashim amdu Yisrael b'me Antiochus b'tzara g'dola. I said, you know what? Hold that line. I'm going to read the next line first. Ze hamispar hem yamim. He says, first of all, Erev Boker is not years. A couple of people suggested that on the chat last week, and I said, hold, we're going to get to it. He says, first of all, rethink this. Erev Boker doesn't mean years. Erev Boker means Vayhi Erev, Vayhi Boker. It was evening, it was morning. It's a 24-hour time period. It's a day. And so we deal with 2,300 days, not 2,300 years. Well, if we're dealing with 2,300 days, what does 2,300 days translate into in just... You put the math to it, and you'll see that it's about 6 years plus, almost 6.5 years, a little bit under 6.5 years. That time, about 6 years, 3 months, actually. And by the time of Pai Shlosh Mot, Hem Shesh Shanim, Shnot Achama, Bishloshach Chodeshim, Biyami. It's about 6 years, you're talking about solar years, 3 months, and 20 some odd days. Mishnat HaChama, 20 days from Mishnat HaLabana. It's about 6.5 years. What's the significance of it being 6.5 years? V'enachon b'enai ki sheish shanim v'chodashim Antiochus b'tzarat b'tala v'chein katuv b'sefer Yevan. Because we have records that they were under the rule of all of his decrees and his terrible campaign against the religious life and religious persecution of Antiochus, the story of Hanukkah, for about 6 years. And so Daniel is talking about those 6 years under the reign of Antiochus. He's the great king that will arise after the great fight against the heavens because of his religious persecution. And those will be the 6 years that he's talking about, the Alpayim Shlosh Meot. And as far as the rest of it goes, he says, well, if I hadn't found this number, 6 years, written in the book of Sefer Yevan, later to Chanukah, and it's already in the past, nobody can understand what 2,300 days refers to. Therefore, that's exactly why Daniel was shocked. Daniel was standing, didn't understand, and Mivini didn't understand the vision. Because the very case of last tumim v'chatumim, the notion of an appointed time for redemption is hidden from us. Because even for Daniel, it was in the past. In other words, for Daniel, he didn't understand what the numbers mean because these events hadn't happened yet. And for us, it's in the past. So says the Abarbanesha, had I not found this number 6 years plus 6 and 2 months, literally in the story of Antiochus, I wouldn't have anywhere to put this story either, says the Abarbanesha. And with that, the Abarbanesha suggests the entire vision is about Greeks and the conflict with Antiochus with the Jews in the story of Hanukkah. That's the interpretation of the Abarbanesha. Now, I mentioned last week that the Barbanel,
We're having a bit of an audio. There's a bit of an audio issue. I'm wondering if maybe.
I'm so sorry.
No, that's okay. But I just, I think it's a bit distracting. Also, I think for the recording, it will be distracting. I'm wondering if you could maybe call in. Because your screen is working fine. Maybe if you call in, we could listen to your audio from the phone.
Yes, I can do that. Okay.
Do you have the number? If not, I'll look it up for you quickly.
You just throw it in the chat real fast. We'll do this right away.
Okay. Here you go. And then the meeting ID and the passcode are also in the chat. Sorry for the breaks. I think that once we do this, we should be.
Overall, the technology has served us very well.
It's true. Thank you for saying so.
Happen. There are worse problems in the world.
It's true. And this should be the worst of it for all of us, right?
Exactly.
Thanks for saying so, Nomi. And our wonderful editor will be able to cut this little pause out of the recording. So lucky for the people that can't join us live, they won't have this little mishap. And thanks to everybody for your patience.
Okay. Can everybody hear me now?
We can. So okay, if you can, you can so mute. No, it's no problem. I think this will be great.
I've taken the computer off audio completely.
Great. I'll mute myself and you can go on. Thanks so much for doing that.
Okay. Appreciate that. No problem at all. Okay. So what I mentioned was the Abarbanel sees this Ebenezer and he reacts to it, but he reacts to it very strongly. And I think in large part of the reason he reacts to it so strongly was because amongst the various undertones in the Abarbanel was a polemic against the attempt by the Christian reading of Daniel to see the numbers as a reference point to their religious frame of reference. And he makes reference to that directly. He says, Daniel, this is the second number that Daniel has seen in his visions. Ukvar pirshu chochmei hanotzrim. It has been already interpreted by the scholars of Christianity and also mimifashei amenu from amongst our, from some of the commentaries amongst our people. Shemispar hazehu liyamim. This number refers to days. That they are 2,300 days that come to 6 years and 3 months and 14 days, and that this was the time of Antiochus's campaign against Israel. It's really direct reference to the Ebenezer's interpretation. And then he goes, he says, "Akatuv lo yisbalu." This cannot, the text doesn't tolerate this for all kinds of reasons. First of all, he says, if it was days, why use this enigmatic phrase, Erev Boker? Secondly, he says, Erev Boker, you can say is a reference to the Erev Boker of creation, because the Malach himself says to Daniel that this Mareha Erev Boker Emetu is true, meaning that it's somehow connected to the symbolism of the message. It says the Ebenezer Shra Ema Hashicha Nofelet Alav. He goes into a deep sleep, he goes into a deep dream, that's the Erev, and or is it Ruav HaBoker, and then there's this light of redemption in the morning, and it doesn't work to refer to it as days, says the Abarbanel. Also, and this is really the key point, he says, if this was referring to Antiochus, why would the Malach say to him, hold this off for many years to come and hide it? And also with regard to Antiochus, it says that Nitzdak Kodesh, the sanctuary, will be victorious. In Achrei Antiochus, can we say that after Antiochus, the sanctuary was victorious? That's only something that's going to happen at the time of the redemption. Furthermore, this number, 6 years, is the reference to Antiochus, is an invented number. We don't have this number. There's no part of the story of Antiochus and the story of Hanukkah that's 6 years in length. They invented this number. We have no reference to this number being six, Antiochus' decrees being 6 years long. And he says, this is inventing numbers. And he takes it to task. He says, not a chance. And so he suggests what we had read last week. But the Ebenezer's argument is still very compelling. The notion that this Erev Boker is referring to days, not years. It's a very compelling suggestion. So I'm going to share with you the possibility, and this was written up in Rav Medan Sefer and Daniel. Much of what I'm going to pull together for this course comes from there as well. And he makes the following suggestion, which I think kind of pulls this Ibn Ezra, but is inspired, I think, by the Ebenezer, but he pulls it in a different direction. And I wonder if we could go back to the text for a second. Raise your hand if you're still seeing the text. Yes, good. Still seeing the text? Yes?
Yeah.
Okay. And I want to go back to Pasuk Yud Aleph, which is where this 2300 comes from. And take a look at this carefully. This last king is going to fight and who the is the subject of this parak. Tatigdal ad tzva shemayim. He will grow mighty haughtily even against the heavens. El arta min tzva min kochavim. He'll throw stars from the heavens down and trample upon them, which is a metaphorical way of saying he'll decree against the heavens. And he'll fight even against the commander of the host. And the burnt offering will be taken away. And the place of the sanctuary shall be cast down. The host was given over it to together with the tamid, the daily offering, bifasha, in transgression. And he'll take this truth and smash it, crush it to the ground, the shlechem et arza, and be prosperous. And then I heard one of the malachim saying to the other malach, saying to him, Ad mataya chazon atamid le'apesha shomem, how long will this vision concerning the burnt offering and the transgression be, so that allowing the sanctuary to be trampled upon, tetz v'kodesh v'tzva mirmah? He answered, Ad Erev Boker, Apayim Shloshim. There's a word in this description that I think could take us into a whole different understanding of the phrase Erev Boker. Because the emphasis here seems to be not on days and not on years, but on... What's that word? Whoops. Ad mimenu huram tamid. Tzavat yinaten al tamid. Ad matay chazon tamid. The whole issue here is the sanctuary and whoever this king is, his ability to essentially stop the operation of the sanctuary. Operation of the sanctuary is symbolized first and foremost, most importantly, by a daily offering in the sanctuary, the korban meat. And so when he says Ad Erev Boker Bayim Shloshmeh, 2,300 evening mornings, says the Ebenezer, we're talking about days, right? But here Erev Boker, maybe we're not even talking about days. Maybe we're talking about 2,300. What's Erev Boker? What is Erev Boker in this context? Zesh, this is a pasuk in Shmot Perach of Tet. Zeh asher ta'aseh lemizbeach kvasim ben shana shnayim layom tamid. The daily offering was two offerings on the altar daily. Et keves ha'achad ta'aseh haboker. Keves ha'sheni ta'aseh ben ha'arbayim. Erev boker would be a reference to the korban tamid. In other words, the question was, how long will the daily offering be suspended? And the answer was 2,300 daily offerings. Answer exactly matches the question. Now we need to do a little math. Okay? So if we do a little math, 2,300 daily offerings, let's work our way backwards. 2,300 daily offerings is how many days? Divide it in half, right? Well, 1,150. Which is more or less, give or take, about three years, a little bit more. We can work through the exact numbers in a minute, but you're dealing with more or less half the amount of time. Instead of 6 years, you're dealing with just over 3 years. Well, if you're dealing with 3 years and not six, now I'll go back to the Ebenezer's thesis, which is the story of Antiochus and the Chashmonaim and the rebellion of the Chashmonaim. And now suddenly the numbers take on a whole new meaning. So I'm going to take you now into the world of the Book of the Maccabees. And the Book of the Maccabees is a story into itself. It's obviously not part of Tanakh, but it is historically very important for us. It's the story of Hanukkah. Much of what we know comes from the story of the Book of the Maccabees. There's a whole broader dimension to the story of the Maccabean revolt and the kingdom of the Maccabees, the Machut Chashmonaim that they established afterwards, and the war with the Greeks. There's a lot to unpack in the Book of the Maccabees. For our purposes, I just want to get the timetable. So we're going to jump to the Book of the Maccabees, Book 1. There's four books of the Maccabees, a whole discussion about what it means, and not for now. But the decrees of Antiochus are identified here very clearly. There are just a kind of a word of understanding in terms of translation. We don't have the original Hebrew of the Book of the Maccabees. It's been lost. So it's been preserved in its Greek original and in translation. So both the Hebrew and the English are translations off the Greek. Hence, therefore, I didn't feel the need to necessarily pull up the Hebrew and then translate it, because they're really both equal translations and equally poor, equally good, depending on how you look at it. But the Book of the Maccabees in Book 1 is sort of the historical context of the story of Hanukkah. Many of the Israelites consented to his religion. This is the beginning of the story. And sacrificed idols and profaned the Sabbath. The king, Antiochus, had sent letters by messengers to Jerusalem and the cities of Judah that they should follow the strange laws of the land and forbid burnt offerings, your carbon tummy, and sacrifice and drink offerings in the temple, that they should profane the Sabbath and festival days and pollute the sanctuary and the holy people and set up altars and chapels of idols and sacrifice swine and unclean beasts, that they should leave their children uncircumcised, that they forget the law and change their laws and practices. And whoever does not do so in accordance with the command of the king should be put to death. In the same manner, he wrote to his whole kingdom and appointed overseers of the people, commanding the cities of Judah to sacrifice city by city. This is the background of Antiochus's decrees against religious persecution. There's much to say about it in the context of Hanukkah. Antiochus, the Greeks were not known for mandating religious observance in terms of fighting against the religions of the nations that they conquered. On the contrary, but there were reasons that were specific to the Jewish people that they refused to, sort of the efforts against Hellenization were great, and ultimately the efforts of Antiochus to take this the area of Judah and to control it, and the great war between the Seleucid dynasties and the Ptolemy dynasty, and so he sets up this period of persecution. Okay. Starting with chapter 1, book 1, chapter 1, verse 54. Now, the 15th day of the month of Kislev, in the 145th year, they set up the abomination of desolation upon the altar. They took an idol and they put it on the Mizbeach, and thereby essentially defiling the altar and making it impossible to use for korbanot. That was done on the 15th day of Kislev, in the year 145 in the calendar of the Greeks. Remember this date and write it down. 15th of Kislev, year 145. And they built altars throughout the cities of Judah on every side, and they burnt incense at the doors of the houses and the streets. And when they had torn to pieces the books of the law which they found, they burnt them with fire. And whoever was found in the book, it was found with any book of the Testament to be committed, or if any committed to the law, the king's commandment was that they should be put to death. Thus they did by their authority, the Israelites, month. Now, they set up that altar on the 15th day of Kislev, correct? Now, the 25th day of Kislev, 10 days later, on the 25th of Kislev, note the date, they did sacrifice upon the idol altar, which was upon the altar of God. In other words, there's a 10-day period between the time that they set the altar on the idol on the altar to the time that they begin to operate this new idol slash altar. And it's unclear what the 10 days is for. I suspect it was a way of publicizing the event, giving 10 days to go around and send a message that this is all going to happen on the 25th. The 25th of Kislev is the day in year 145 was the day in which this altar went into operation. The sacrifices, the temple has now been defiled. Skip to chapter four. After all the beginning of the wars against the Greeks by the Maccabees, the revolt is underway. And at some point during the early part of the revolt, they liberate Yerushalayim and they go in to clean the temple. Then Judas and his brethren said, behold, our enemies are discomfited. Let's go and cleanse and dedicate the sanctuary. On this, they assembled themselves together and went up to Mount Zion. And when they saw the sanctuary desolate and the altar profaned and the gates burnt and the shrubs growing in the courts, one of the mountains, the priest's chambers had been pulled down. They tore their clothing. They made great lamentation. They put ashes upon their heads. They fell to the ground. They blew an alarm with the trumpets and they cried to the heavens. And Judah appointed men to fight those who were in the fortress. They were still fighting the war with the Greeks. There's a myth that the war ended with the story of Hanukkah. That is a total myth. The war goes on for years after the events of Hanukkah. And he chose priests of blameless conversation, such as the pleasure of the law, who cleansed the sanctuary, and they pour out the defiled stones. And when they consulted what to do with the altar, which had been so profaned, and they thought it best to just pull it down, lest it be a source of reproach for them, and the heathens had defiled it. And so they put the stones on the mountain, etc., and they took new stones, and they built a new altar, which is why they needed to dedicate the altar, hence Chanukat HaMizbeach, which is where the Chanukah comes from. And they made up the sanctuary and things, etc. They made new vessels and the temple, new menorah, new candlesticks, and the altar burnt offerings and incense, and the shulchan. And upon the altar, they burned incense and the lamps that were upon the candlesticks they lit, that they might have light to the temple. They put the bread, the showbread, the lechem apanim, on the table. Now, here's the punchline. On the 5th and 20th day of the 9th month, which is called the month of Kislev, meaning on the very anniversary of the day in which the Greeks had defiled the temple, on that day, in year 148, they rose up in the morning and offered sacrifices according to the law upon the new altar of burnt offerings which they had made. And don't think the date was arbitrary. Look at what time and what day the heathens had profaned it. Even in that was it dedicated with songs and cisterns and harps and cymbals and all kinds of instruments. Meaning, the choice of the 25th of Kislev was intentional. Picked the choice of the day of the 25th of Kislev for the dedication ceremony because that was the anniversary of 3 years later from the time that the Greeks had defiled it by bringing an altar, or bringing an offering on this altar to Zeus. At the 10 days from which they had started, which they had ceased the operation of the altar 10 days early. Then everybody fell on their faces and they praised God and they sang hallel and songs, etc. And Judah and his brethren, with the whole congregation of Israel, ordained that the days of the dedication of the altar should be kept in the season from year to year in the space of 8 days, from the 5th and 20th of Kislev, together with mirth and gladness and celebration. And there's your 8 days. Later it talks about 8 days parallel to the holiday of Sukkot, because that's how their frame of reference for an eight-day holiday. Okay, so no question that the story of Chanukah focuses from the time that the temple altar is defiled until the time that it is rededicated under Yehuda, Maccabim, and the Hashmonaim. That is a 3 year plus timetable, more or less. However, because we're dealing not with months or years or even days, but with burnt offerings, korban tamid, the calculation gets a little trickier. We're talking about from the 145th year and the 15th of Kislev, the 15th of Kislev, which is when the story began, to the 25th of Kislev, and then another 8 days. Now, let's go back to the number 2,300 korban tamid. Work with me for a second. Let's make an assumption that if we're dealing with Kislev here, we're dealing with lunar months or Jewish calendar years, not solar calendar years, which was the Ebenezer's assumption. If we're dealing with lunar calendar years, we don't necessarily know how many leap years there are in that period of time. But on average, there is a leap year, either one every 3 years or two every 3 years. You now have a calendar cycle works. So let's make an arbitrary assumption. Within those 3 year time period, there are two leap years. If there are two leap years, just because it's possible, right, that happens depends where you are in the 19 year cycle, then a lunar year is 384 days if it's a leap year. The two leap years is 768 days. A regular lunar year is 354 days. So the three the 3 years of that time period would be a total of 1,122 days. Now add between the 10th of Kislev and the 15th of Kislev, but then they add the extra 8 days all the way to the end of the celebration, and you get another 17, 18 days from the 15th of Kislev till the 8 days of the celebration. So let's assume for the moment 17 days. You end up with a total of 1,139 days. You with me? You want to just trust me on that? Now, if you have 1,139 days, multiply that by 2, because there are 2 korban tamid per day. What's the total number of daily offerings so far? 2,278. Okay, round that off to the nearest 100. 2,300. In other words, it's entirely possible that what this vision is about is a nevuah about the time period of this last king who will set his sights, this Greek king, who will set his sights against the heavens and ultimately challenge the temple and abolish the Korban Tamid, and that his reign will be for approximately 3 years plus, or 2,300 approximately, daily offerings. The measured time on this abominable king who defiled the altar, we're going to measure time in altar clicks, daily offerings, twice a day. Erev, Boker, Korban Tamid, Ella, Alpaim, Shloshmot. And then the question becomes, and this is really where we have to come back to the story, and then the question becomes, okay, and then what? And then Benitzdak Kodesh, and then the sanctuary will be victorious. Well, says the Abarbanel to the Ebenezer, that didn't happen. We're still waiting for Mashiach. Well, the answer to that question we addressed back in the first time I suggested that Daniel's vision was about Hanukkah and is about the Hashmonim and was about the Greeks. Namely, that every prophecy in the world of the Nevi'im is not about some far-off future time of 3,000, 2,000 years from now, but rather has a potential of being much closer on the radar screen. And that what Daniel was talking about is the same vision that Haggai was talking about, the potential for the second temple to be the final temple, to be the redemption, for Zerubbabel, who was the leader of the and of the Jewish community in Babel, the governor of Judah, Zerubbabel, who was a descendant of David, to be the Melech HaMashiach. And Haggai was the last of the Nevi'im. Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. Haggai was very explicit in he has several nevuot about the building of the temple. And he says to the people, he says, this is a nevuot on the 21st of, on the 21st of Tishrei. He has this nevuah, and he says to speak to Zerubbabel ben Shealtiel b'chat Yehudah, and to Yeshua the Kohen Gadol, and to the rest of the people who are standing, that just founded, they just put laid the foundation stones of this temple. And he says to them, Mi bachem anishara shirat abayit ezeh b'chvodo rishon, you who see this house, who you saw it in its former kavod, in its former glory. The kavod here doesn't mean how big the building is and how decorative it is and how much gold there is. The kavod here, when we talk about the kavod, when we talk about the kvod of the temple, what does kvod of the temple refer to? Kvod of the temple refers to the Shekhinah. We say it and we see it in Chumash all over the place. The glory of God, the kvod Hashem, filled the sanctuary. Moshe couldn't enter the sanctuary because the cloud was upon it, because kvod Hashem maleh mishkan. Kvod Hashem is referring to the Shekhinah, the presence of the Shekhinah. Haggai says to the people, he says, you are looking at this temple. You saw this temple in its earlier glory, in its earliest form with the Shekhinah and the Eish and the miracles. What do you see now? what you see is nothing. It's like nothing in your eyes. You see a shadow. You see a shell. You see a structure. You see it's void of substance. It's void of sanctity. There's no Shekhinah. There's no magic kingdom. There's no temple. There's no ark in the temple. There's a guide to the people. Chazak Zerubbabel. Be strong. Chazak Yoshua ben Yitzadak. Be strong, Yoshua. Chazak Kol Amaretz. Be strong, the people. I am with you, says Hashem. V'asuk ani etchenu Hashem. This is what I want you to do. I want you to build it. I want you to create it. Why? Because look at the potential it has. Ki komar Hashem tzvot. Oh, the chad ma'ati. You are building this temple. You know what you're doing? You're building this temple under Persian rule. You're building this temple under foreign occupation. You're building this temple under the kingdom of Persia. But that's temporary. The people didn't want to build the temple. They didn't want to build the temple because the king of Persia said they could build it. And the king of Persia rescinded that decision to build the temple. And then the king of Persia said they could build it again. And the people didn't want to do it. And Haggai says, then do it anyway. Oh, the chad ma'ati, in just a little while. Just be patient. I'm going to create a turmoil and I'm going to create an earthquake that's going to shake the foundations of the earth. And I am going to shake the nations there. Ashtiot kol agoyim. And then, v'ochemdat kol agoyim, the nations will come and they will give honor to this place. And then, mileiti et habayit hazeh kavod. I will fill this house with the Shekhinah's presence with kavod. Not only that. Kadol yekvod habayit hazeh achorim min harishon. The kavod, the Shekhinah of this house, the greatness, the glory, the power, the potential of this house will be greater than even the first one. And there'll be peace in this land. Just be patient. Build it. Do it. Then another nevuah that comes to him shortly thereafter. In the 24th of the month. And more of Zerubbabel Pachat Yudah tells Zerubbabel, especially Zerubbabel, who has a stake in this. Zerubbabel, the governor of Judah, appointed by Persia. I'm going to overthrow kingdoms. I'm going to shake the foundations of the earth. And overthrow regimes and overthrow kingdoms. I'm going to destroy the strength of kingdoms of nations. And when I do, you know what's going to happen? I will take you, Zerubbabel, and I will make you into a king. There's Rashi. What is this a vision about? What is this a nevuah about? This nevuah of Haggai says, Rashi, Odechad Ma'ati, I will turn kingdoms upside down. When I undo this kingdom of Persia that's ruling over you now into the days of Haggai when you're building the temple, Takum Nimshol Alechem Atzal Alechem Od Malchut Yavan, there will come another kingdom after Persia, called Greece. Ma'ati is ma'mem shota. It will rule for only a little while. And then, ani ma'ish b'nisim ha'na'asim l'vnei chashmonai, I will turn miracles in the days of the chashmonaim. And those days of the chashmonaim, the rebellion of the chashmonaim, will be a fulfillment of this prophecy, says Haggai. Kvod yabon, kodol yekvod habayit hazeh acharon min harishon. I'll fill this house with the sanctuary. I'll fill this house with the Shekhinah. In other words, the core issue here is independence. The core issue here is that they're building the temple under Persian rule, and that was an anathema to everything the temple stood for. The temple the Mikdash was a palace. It was a palace to the king. It was a palace to the king of kings. And the palace of the earthly king, the Kisei Machut of David HaMelech or Shlomo HaMelech, sat in proximity to the Mikdash was not an accident. And here they were building the temple under because Persia said they could build a temple because Persia gave them permission. And they were crying and there was no Shekhinah and there was a shell. Ezra has a similar description. Ezra is a little bit later. But the founder of the temple, Yisdu Abayit, at the Chal Hashem, And they're all celebrating and they're dancing and they're having a wonderful. This is all in times of Zerubbabel. Same. This is before Ezra comes. Rabim Yakoanim Aleviim Bereshei Avotas Kenim Asheruot Abayit Harishon BiYozdo. The many of the Kohanim and the Leviim and the elders who saw the first temple, Abayit and him, this Abayit in their eyes was nothing. Bochim, they were crying. Younger generation. They were celebrating and calling out and dancing because they were finally built the temple. And you couldn't tell the difference, says Ezra, between the book of Ezra, between the noise of the shouting from the noise of the weeping, because it was all intermingled. All because of the question of sovereignty, the Samticha Kachotam. The Navi says to Zerubbabel, wait, it'll come. And when it comes, and the rebellion of the Hashmonaim will finally throw off the yoke of Greece, then I will make you into a king. Then you'll have the opportunity to build your temple, to build the sanctuary, and to create the Shekhinah. And all points of the Nevi'im, in the end of beginning of Bayit Sheni, Haggai, and Zechariah, who makes a similar reference, and Daniel, are all converging on the potential story of the Hashmonaim. And the ability of the rebellion of the Hashmonaim to transform the temple into what it was intended to be. Because after the rebellion of the Hashmonaim, what you achieved was two things. You now had a purified temple, but you also had something else. The whole point of the rebellion was to rid them of Antiochus's rule. It's exactly what Daniel is talking about. Rid them of the rule of this king who waged war against the heavens. And 2,300 Korban Tamins later, they finally declare the temple free of the influence of the Greeks, and they declare themselves the sovereign in the land of Israel, and they have that extraordinary combination of finally having their temple back under Jewish sovereign rule, perfect combination for everything in the Nevi'im we talked about. If, here's the key question, if they are worthy, meaning every prophecy in Tanakh is potential prophecy, redemption prophecy, geula prophecy, even if it's a specific about a specific time, and you can't get more specific than Daniel's reference to 2300 Tamid. Always conditional upon the people being able to step up to that responsibility. And we know from the story of the Hashmonaim that in the aftermath of the rebellion, the glory days were short-lived, because what they then did, unfortunately, was degenerate themselves into internal conflict and civil war. But the potential the Nevi'im talked about was all there. The Rambam writes this summary up in an extraordinary fashion. If I jump to the Rambam, the laws of Hanukkah, it's Perek Gimel, but it's the first of the laws of Hanukkah, because the first two chapters are about Purim. The Rambam has an introduction to the story of Hanukkah, and the Rambam articulates this in a unique fashion, and all of the subsequent halachic literature from the Torah, the Shulchan Aruch, and on copy this language of the Rambam. The Rambam was the first to formulate it in this fashion. The story of the Nes, the miracle of the oil, is in Halacha 2. Halacha 1 is the background and the history. And what it says there is, in the second days of the Second Temple, when the Greeks ruled over Israel, and they made decrees, ubitlud datam, and they abolished their laws, and they wouldn't allow us to engage in the study of Torah or the performance of mitzvot, and they took our money, and they took our daughters, and they entered into the sanctuary, and they defiled it, and they created great distress for us. That's all in the story of the Book of the Maccabees. Ad shirichem aleihem alakei avoteinu v'oshia miyadam, until God had compassion upon us and enabled us to save us and saved us from their hand. Metzilam. Now listen to the last sentence. V'gavu b'nei chashmonai ha-kohanim ha-gdolim, b'nei chashmonai the Kohanim, were victorious, and they were able to throw off the Greeks for Aragum. V'oshir Yisrael miyadam, they saved Israel from their hands, the great accomplishment of Hanukkah. Emidu melech min ha-kohanim b'chazra malchut l'Yisrael yeter al 200 shana ad ha-churban ha-sheni. They established a king from amongst the Kohanim, and they restored Jewish sovereignty to the land of Israel for more than 200 years until the destruction of the Second Temple. The great accomplishment of Hanukkah was the reestablishment of Jewish sovereignty. Cannot state that, overstate that. Great accomplishment of Hanukkah was the establishment of Jewish sovereignty, says the Rambam. The Malchut Hashemim, with all of its complexity and all of its troubles and all of its challenges, but for 200 years the Jews were sovereign in the land of Israel. That's what we celebrate in Hanukkah. And then there's the story of the Greeks and of the oil. Shagavu Yisrael, and they entered into the temple and they couldn't find the oil for lasting for more than one day. They needed oil for 8 days, and the miracle occurred and the oil lasted for 8 days. They were celebrating for 8 days. They needed oil for the menorah, as the Book of the Maccabees says, because they needed oil to stay lit for the entire celebration. I wonder if you've ever given thought to the question as to why the miracle of the oil doesn't appear in the Book of the Maccabees. You've heard that before, right? The miracle of the oil doesn't appear in the Book of the Maccabees. I'll share with you what I think is the reason for why it doesn't appear in the Book of the Maccabees. Every dedication of the temple in Chumash was accompanied by a miracle of fire. When the Shechina came down on Yom HaShemini, in the eighth day of the temple, in the story of the dedication, we just read it a couple of weeks ago, there was a great fire, Umareh Kvod Hashem, the fire of HaSinai, the Kvod Hashem Ke'esh Uchalot, fire consuming on the top of the mountain. In Vayikra, Vayera Kvod Hashem, this Kvod Hashem, this glory, this presence appeared to the people, and a fire came out and consumed on the altar. That fire prevented Moshe from entering the Mishkan because it filled the Mishkan, Kvod Hashem, the Shechina, which is in the form of the fire. Fire and cloud is the same thing. The cloud is the smoke created by the fire. In Divrei Hayamim, it describes Shlomo HaMelech's temple. And when Shlomo built the temple in Yerushalayim, Chalot Shlomo Beitalel, the Ha'esh Yardam in Hashemayim, fire came out from the heaven. U'kvod Hashem Aleh Tabayit, and the glory of God filled the house. When the Chashmonaim rededicated the temple and were established Jewish sovereignty for the first time, and they lit the menorah, you know what they were expecting? No doubt. What they were expecting was Vatetze Esh Min HaShemayim, the Esh Yardam Min HaShemayim, fire come down from heaven. You know what they got? They got a tiny little spark flicker in the candle, the last light, so it didn't go out, so it stayed lit from day to day. That's not fire from heaven. They were expecting the fire to come down from heaven and burn on the new altar. It didn't happen. And it didn't happen for all kinds of reasons, and the Chashmoni had a long journey ahead of them. But I suspect fully that that's why they didn't include the miracle of the oil in the Book of the Maccabees, because to them it was a terrible disappointment. They were expecting fire from heaven. What they got was a spark. But from the vantage point of the accomplishment of Hanukkah, the Rambam says, the first primary accomplishment was the restoration of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel that would enable everything else, if they lived up to their potential. That's the message of the Nevi'im, that's the message of Haggai, it's the message of all of the Geula from Yechezkel and Yirmiyahu. They're not about 2,000 years later. They're about the potential of all they need is Jewish sovereignty, reestablish Malchut Yisrael and build the temple, and the Shekhinah comes back, and the pieces are all there. And that's precisely what Daniel was looking for. Daniel was looking for Daniel was about a prophecy that said the following, to summarize it in one sentence. Where are we? We are in the third year of Belshazzar. Babel is about to fall. Babel is going to fall to Persia. Guess what, Persia? You're short-lived. Because Persia is going to be taken over by And guess what, Greece? Alexander the Great conquers the world. Plus Alexander the Great, there'll be other divisions, and there'll be other kings, and there'll be kings who will fight against heaven, there'll be kings who will fight against Israel, and Israel will find themselves, at some point in the future, Israel will find themselves in a moment where in all of this turmoil, they can throw off the shackles of oppression, and they can reestablish their own sovereignty. When, says Daniel, 2300 Talmids. Do the math. Nobody knew what that meant. We know what that meant in hindsight. Then the burden and responsibility will rest on the shoulders of the newly established Malchut Hashmonai and the independence they create to see whether they can live up to the potential of the Nevi'im. But it's totally all dependent upon them. And that's what the message of all the Nevi'im focused on, and especially Daniel. Persia, short-lived. Greece, short-lived. He saw up to Greece, not further than Greece, because Daniel's visions are about Hanukkah. They're about the establishment of Jewish sovereignty in the aftermath of Antiochus. That's where his nevuot stop. That's where his message is. I've brought you to that place. You're now there. You now have sovereignty. You now have a mikdash. And what you do with it is up to you. Let's say I'm going to stop here. And I apologize for you not being able to see me. But at least you heard me. And I hope you were able to see the sources. And for now, I'm going to leave it at that. I think what we'll do is I have to fix my computer, but we'll figure that glitch out. And but I hope you have a meaningful Yom HaAtzmaut. I hope this message also, I didn't connect it directly, but I think you understand the potential message it has for our generation in context of Israel today, which I think the great accomplishment of Yom HaAtzmaut, not to be overstated, not to be to be missed, is the restoration of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel, nothing short of biblical in proportion and consequence. And there are many other miracles related to Hanukkah. That's the story.
Thank you, Rabbi Shulman.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach to you all.
There were no questions in the chat. I don't know if anybody has anything else they wanted to ask or mention before we separate for today, before Rabbi Shulman goes.
And have a wonderful day. And I really, sorry for the technical glitches, and hopefully we'll sort it all out. Mm-hmm. All right, take care.
All the best. Chag Sameach.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye, everybody.